Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Authority Gap. Why women are taken less seriously than men, and what we can do about it. By Marianne Sieghart. Narrated by Marianne Sieghart.
To Die, the Unlikely Feminist. Introduction. Why Bart Simpson has more authority than Margaret Thatcher. He tells her that the earth is flat. He knows the facts, and that is that. In altercations fierce and long, she tries her best to prove him wrong, but he has learned to argue well. He calls her arguments unsound, and often asks her not to yell. She cannot win. He stands his ground. The planet goes on being round. Wendy Cope. When Mary McAleese was President of the Republic of Ireland, she led an official visit to the Vatican to meet Pope John Paul II. She was in the audience room at the head of her delegation, about to be introduced to the pontiff, when he reached straight past her, held out his hand to her husband instead, and asked him, "Would you not prefer to be President of Ireland, rather than married to the President of Ireland?" Her husband knew better than to take the bait. As McAleese told me in an interview for this book, "I reached and took the hand which was hovering in mid-air and said, 'Let me introduce myself. I am the President of Ireland, Mary McAleese, elected by the people of Ireland, whether you like it or whether you don't.'" The Pope later claimed it was a joke, but if so, it was in poor taste. It managed to snub a head of state before even acknowledging her presence. As McAleese recalled, he said, "I'm sorry, I tried a joke because I heard you had a great sense of humour." I said, "I do, but that wasn't funny, because you would not have done that to a male president." We would automatically respect a male head of state, so why not a female one? Because there is still an authority gap between women and men. This sort of behaviour is incredibly frustrating for women. No one likes to be treated as if they're inferior, particularly if they're not. To see this more clearly, it helps to flip things around. So, if you're a man, I'd like you to take a moment or two to do this thought experiment. Imagine living in a world in which you are routinely patronised by women. Imagine having your views ignored or your expertise frequently challenged by them. Imagine trying to speak up in a meeting only to be talked over by female colleagues. Imagine women subordinates resisting you as a boss, merely because of your gender. Imagine women superiors promoting other women, even if they're less talented than you. Imagine people always addressing the woman you're with before they address you. Imagine writing a book and finding that half the population is reluctant to read it because it's written by a man. Would you just shrug your shoulders and say, "Well, that's fair enough, men are different from women"? Or would it infuriate you? I think I can guess. RESPECT is what the soul singer Aretha Franklin demanded, and it's what women still have to fight harder than men to earn. However much we claim to believe in equality, we're still in practice more reluctant to accord authority to women than to men, even when they're leaders or experts. Every woman has a tale to tell about being underestimated, talked over, ignored, patronised, and generally not taken as seriously as a man. And when I say woman, I mean anyone who identifies as a woman. Great strides have been made, and many men are good and respectful listeners. But however liberal we think we are, we're nowhere near there. Research shows that we still expect women to be less expert than men. Most of us, men and women, are still less willing to be influenced by women's views. And we still resist the idea of women having authority over us. In other words, there's still an authority gap between women and men. And the authority gap is the mother of all gender gaps. If women aren't taken as seriously as men, they're going to be paid less, promoted less, and held back in their careers. They're going to feel less confident and less entitled to success. If we don't do anything about it, the gap between women and men in the public sphere will never disappear. That gap is both huge and unmerited. The difference between the amount that women and men are paid and promoted is 14 times greater than the difference between their performance evaluations. This is because 70% of men rate men more highly than women for achieving the same goals. And in really prestigious jobs in professions and senior management, women and men perform equally well, but women are paid significantly less. This is at least in part because we're still too ready to associate male with authority. When I put together some slides to give a lecture on this subject at Oxford University, I knew I had to start by defining my terms. So I took a screenshot of the Oxford Dictionary Online's definition of authority, the very first result to come up on my Google search. Every sentence it offered as an example began with the same pronoun. He had absolute authority over his subordinates. He has the natural authority of one who is used to being obeyed. He hit the ball with authority, and he was an authority on the stock market. I couldn't have found a neater illustration of the problem. Yet didn't Margaret Thatcher have the natural authority of one who is used to being obeyed? Doesn't Serena Williams hit a ball with authority? Isn't Helena Morrissey an authority on the stock market? I wasn't looking for this differential treatment, only for a dictionary definition. The same happened when I searched in Google Images for something to illustrate a slide on expertise. In the first 20 pictures, there wasn't a single woman. Bart Simpson appeared before we reached the first female in a group with men. Finally, there was a decent-sized photo of a woman, but it turned out that she was having something explained to her by a male expert. Sometimes your subject just jumps up and slaps you in the face. Surely this is all changing now, though. We're at last appointing more women to top jobs, and hooray for that. We now berate the Academy Award voters for ignoring female directors and are thrilled when more meaty parts are written for women. But what we've been seeing in the developed world since Me Too is a kind of lip service feminism. We're still more likely to follow and retweet men than women on Twitter. We're still more likely, when we walk up to a man and a woman standing together, to address the man first. Men are still more inclined to ignore books written by women, though women lap up books written by men. Unconscious bias seems to dog every step forward we take, and we're far too ready to congratulate ourselves for the progress we've made and ignore or fail to notice the bias that still exists. In this book, I want to examine our biases in detail and map out the measures we can take as individuals and as a society to spot them, counteract them, and see them for what they are, an irrational and anachronistic product of social conditioning and outdated stereotypes. Our brains are used to taking shortcuts, what psychologists call heuristics, and dividing the world into categories so that we don't have to process too much information. We overlay these templates onto something like a transparent film between us and the person we're interacting with. Instead of treating each person as an individual, we map onto them our assumptions about what they should be like or what we expect them to be like, based on the stereotypes we've been brought up with and are surrounded by. We associate men with leadership in the outside world and women with home. These stereotypes may bear no resemblance to the actual person in front of us, but that doesn't stop us applying them. As Helle Thorning-Schmidt, the former Danish Prime Minister, put it to me, we are people who walk around with a brain that is wired to be extremely prejudiced against female leaders, because it just goes against the grain of what our Stone Age brain can capture. It doesn't have to be evolutionarily determined from the Stone Age, though. It can be socially constructed from the contemporary world. It's easy to underestimate how fundamental these templates are. We may have a sincere moral and intellectual objection to women being treated any differently from men. But the trouble is that once we've learned to see the world in a particular way, we may not even be aware of our subliminal prejudices. They're conveyed to us at too fundamental a level. As scientists of consciousness would explain, they are inextricably woven into the way we perceive the world. Of course, there are also authority chasms between white and minority ethnic people, between people from different classes, between the able-bodied and the disabled, and between straight people and those with other sexualities, Each of these gaps deserves a whole book of its own, but I'm not the right person to write those books. So I'm mainly confining myself here to the gender authority gap, though I do also explore how it intersects with other biases. The authority gap affects women all over the world, whatever the differences in culture. I've talked to women from Africa, Latin America, Asia and the Middle East, as well as from Europe and America, and they all say that they have experience of being taken less seriously than men. We might not notice that we interrupt them more, challenge their expertise more, and listen to them less. But many of us do, and it's both insulting and wrong. It makes women fume, it dents their confidence, and it holds them back. It's high time we changed our behaviour. Even the most senior of women experience it, particularly women of colour. I talked to Bernardine Evaristo, Booker Prize-winning novelist and professor of creative writing. Despite her impeccable credentials, her evident brilliance, and her charismatic personality, she still has to fight to persuade people to accord her the authority she deserves. Especially a certain type of older white male student, she says, who has come to learn from me but doesn't really believe that I have anything to teach him and will then challenge everything I say. I have positions in my life where I have authority, she told me. I'm a professor at a university and I'm vice chair of the Royal Society of Literature. I've now won the Booker. I've reviewed books and written essays for newspapers for decades. So on the outside you think, well, this is somebody who walks with authority. But actually, that's not how I'm treated by society. I'm very aware of it, that people don't automatically give me the authority that they would give someone else who they think should be in the positions that I hold. And it's not just men who do it. This isn't a man-bashing book. It's a consciousness-raising exercise for us all. For however progressive and intelligent we think we are, innumerable scientific studies show that we all, women as well as men, have unconscious biases, even against our own gender. We may not be aware of them, they're called unconscious for a reason. But they spill out into our behaviour, and unless we notice and correct for them, we'll continue to take women less seriously than men. We'll continue to assume that a man knows what he's talking about until he proves otherwise, while for a woman, it's all too often the other way around. The authority gap will remain as wide as ever. I'm not exempt myself. I'm not sure that any of us are. I'm a lifelong feminist, and I've written a book begging the world to take women more seriously, but I too can suffer from this bias. Sometimes I'll hear a young woman being interviewed on the radio, who maybe has a high voice and sounds a bit childish in the way that men never do because their voices break. And I'll find myself thinking, I wonder if she knows what she's talking about. Of course, I immediately feel guilty and try to compensate. I'll listen carefully to what she's saying and then judge her on the content of her speech, not the pitch of her voice. Because it's only if we spot our bias in the first place and then actively correct for it that things can begin to change. Over the course of writing this book, I've interviewed about 50 of the world's most powerful, successful, and authoritative women to see whether even they have experience of the authority gap. Frances Morris is right at the top of the art world. She's the director of Tate Modern. But that only insulates her from the authority gap when people already know what she does. We met in her office, brimming with books at the vast London Gallery. She's startlingly intelligent and talks in fully formed paragraphs. As director of Tate Modern, I can spend all day as a powerful, articulate person who's taken seriously, and I can leave this building and I am nobody, she told me. Because as a woman in the world out there, I'm not taken seriously. I'm very often in situations where people don't know my job, and my hand is shaken after the hand of a male colleague, my eyes are met after the eyes of my husband are met, and no interest is shown in my opinion if it's just my opinion as a late middle-aged female. I see all that because it's in stark contrast with the way I'm approached and treated when it's known I'm the director of Tate Modern. Might that not also be true of men in a similar position? No, she insisted. I've worked for 3 male directors of Tate Modern, and it hasn't happened to them. I'm sure that Frances Morris is an avowed feminist. I doubt that Elaine Chao is. But you don't have to be feminist to notice or care about these things. When I met her, Chao was US Transportation Secretary and a member of President Trump's cabinet. We talked in her Washington office with two of her long-standing female aides. Exuding confidence, and clearly one of those women who's used to dominating a room, she told me it had taken her until her late 40s before she felt she was being listened to as much as her male colleagues. It finally happened when she became Labour Secretary under George W. Bush. "Isn't that amazing?" she asked. "I was 47 years old. For the first time in my life, I felt as if I'd kind of made it." But she'd held several top leadership jobs before then, including director of the US Peace Corps. So if she wasn't listened to properly in those positions, it's a sign of how pervasive the authority gap is. Women, even very senior ones, are so used to manifestations of the authority gap that they're pleasantly surprised when it doesn't show. Baroness Hale, then president of the UK Supreme Court, told me that she was taken aback when she and her male deputy hosted a meeting and the visitor, for once, addressed most of his questions to her rather than her deputy. It made her realise how unusual this was, even though she was the most senior person in the room and in the whole judiciary. So why tell these top women's stories? If even super powerful women have had their authority challenged, their views ignored, and their expertise questioned, then it's a pretty good indicator that the rest of womankind have too. If they've managed to overcome this problem, their experiences can be useful to the rest of us with much less privilege from all backgrounds in all walks of life. But I've also talked to less well-known women, a diverse range across age, race, and class. In the process, I haven't met a single one who hasn't encountered this phenomenon. From baby boomers through to Gen X's, millennials, and Gen Z's. Alice, a 27-year-old engineer, told me, "When I'm leading a team, if there's a guy in exactly the same position, I get questioned a lot more. I have to fight more for the same sense of authority. My experience counts, but not as much as a man." Spotting our own biases is a start, but it's not the end. We need to address the problem at a structural level too. As long as we see many more men than women in positions of authority, we'll tend to associate men with authority and women with subordinate status. As long as we allow boys to grow up believing that they're superior to girls, we're instilling habits of mind that will be very hard to change in later life. As long as we keep women in the workplace down by punishing them for being as assertive or self-promoting as men, they'll never advance in the same numbers. And as long as we make work patterns unfriendly for parents of both genders, we're going to prevent women from reaching the positions of authority they need for society to rebalance its stereotypes. In some countries, the bias isn't remotely unconscious, but runs visibly through the veins of the whole society. The documentary maker Sharmeen Obaid-Chinoy has won two Oscars for her films highlighting the lowly status of women in Pakistan. "Pakistan is a highly misogynistic country. It's deeply patriarchal," she told me. "Whether it's in small towns, villages, or big cities, by and large, men make decisions for women. Very few women are allowed to make decisions about their own lives. You'll find the most educated women, the most empowered women on paper, unable to make simple decisions about their lives. And if they rebel against this? The women who have the courage to articulate, to ask, to push, to demand more rights are maligned, are labelled, and are often killed. So very few women now dare to publicly do that. In the developed world, thankfully, women are usually allowed to make decisions about their own lives. They can and do speak out for their rights without having to fear for their lives. But that doesn't mean that the problem has been solved. But covert sexism is very hard to fight. It's far easier for perpetrators to deny or dismiss. Women who complain about instances of it can be caricatured as chippy, oversensitive, or humourless, or told they're being hysterical and making it up. In the cases of women such as Mary McAleese, Frances Morris, and Elaine Chao, I somehow doubt it. Their stories give credence to those of the rest of us. What do we mean by authority? I'm using two definitions. The first is the influence that people have as a result of their knowledge and expertise. In other words, being considered authoritative on a subject. The second is the exertion of power and leadership. In other words, having authority as a result of being in charge. This could as easily refer to authority within a family as to authority in the public sphere. But in this book, I'm writing about authority outside the home. Women throughout history have too often been palmed off with being given charge of the household. That's fine for some, but for many of us, it's not enough. We deserve to be treated equally in all walks of life. So how can an authority gap persist in the 21st century, when we've had two female prime ministers and women as president of the Supreme Court, first ministers of Scotland and Northern Ireland, and commissioner of the Metropolitan Police? If authority is wrapped up with power and leadership, shouldn't we be over this by now? And if not, isn't it just a phenomenon of the older generation who were brought up with values formed in the 1960s and 70s, when women still gushed in TV ads about Persil washing whiter and men in suits bossed their secretaries around? Surprisingly, perhaps, we're still at it, even the young. I've talked to female university students who are clearly as clever as their male counterparts. Yet even they find themselves patronised and underestimated. Flora, 20, says, "I have to work harder than the males in the group do to put my point across. Especially in a group that's male-dominated, people tend to listen first to the men. If a man tries to take charge in a group scenario, they're often taken more seriously. When female friends make suggestions, they're often shut down by the men making jokey comments, which encourages other members of the group to chime in." Ellie, 20, adds, "In my subject group, the men prefer to work together and exclude the women from interacting with them academically. There's an assumption that we're not their intellectual equals." The trouble is, changes in the outside world take a long time to percolate into our subconscious, to change the stereotypes that lurk there. Until then, we have to actively notice when our unconscious bias plays tricks on our thoughts about other people, and that isn't easy. As Julia Gillard, former Prime Minister of Australia, who's co-written a book about women and leadership, told me, "We've never lived in an environment free of any stereotyping. We've never lived with true gender equality. So even young people who are very highly sensitised and don't want to be discriminating on the basis of gender or indeed on the basis of anything else can't shed all of that social conditioning just through an act of will. You can't say, 'I'm a feminist,' and somehow all your social conditioning is gone. We need to be second-guessing what's happening in our brains so we don't just give in to it." But why does this happen? Well, millennia of men being in charge of the patriarchy have made their mark on our minds. They've made it quite normal for men to condescend to women and to treat them as subordinate. As recently as the early 20th century, the novelist Arnold Bennett wrote a book called Our Women, which included a chapter entitled, "Are Men Superior to Women?" It's not clear why he bothered to use a question mark, but in it he wrote, "The truth is that intellectually and creatively, man is the superior of women, and that in the region of creative intellect, there are things that men almost habitually do, but which women have not done and give practically no sign of ever being able to do." No wonder the book enraged Virginia Woolf, who wrote two letters to the New Statesman taking issue with it. Aiming her barbs at the Statesman's literary editor, Desmond McCarthy, who had reviewed Bennett's book under the nom de plume of Affable Hawk, Woolf wrote, "The fact that women are inferior to men in intellectual power," he says, "stares him in the face." He goes on to agree with Mr. Bennett's conclusion that no amount of education and liberty of action will sensibly alter it. How then does Affable Hawk account for the fact, which stares me, and I should have thought any other impartial observer in the face, that the 17th century produced more remarkable women than the 16th, the 18th and the 17th, and the 19th than all three put together? In short, though the pessimism about the other sex is always delightful and invigorating, it seems a little sanguine of Mr. Bennett and Affable Hawk to indulge in it with such certainty on the evidence before them. Thus, though women have every reason to hope the intellect of the male sex is steadily diminishing, it would be unwise until they have more evidence than the Great War and the Great Peace Supply to announce it as a fact. Even among those with average intellect, Bennett claimed that men were still superior. "Every man knows in his heart, and every woman knows in her heart, that the average man has more intellectual power than the average woman. It is a fact as notorious as the fact that a man has more physical strength than a woman." This book was published in the 1920s, the same decade as my mother was born, a woman who won places at both Oxford and Cambridge at the age of 16, despite having missed out on several years of schooling thanks to the Second World War. It would be a foolish man who dared to write such nonsense today in the face of scientific evidence showing women to be absolutely the intellectual equal of men. But we still had V.S. Naipaul, the novelist, claiming in 2011 that no female writer had ever written as well as he. And the American writer Norman Mailer writing in 1959 that "a good novelist can do without anything but his balls." And the problem is that the world around us is still designed and led mainly by men. Most of us have grown up with our fathers working more and earning more than our mothers. We see in all walks of public life men making it more often to the top and men being cited as authorities much more often than women. We've watched too many films in which men are the protagonists and women the helpmeets or sex objects, in which men have twice as many speaking parts, almost all of which are directed by men. We still live in a world in which men have the upper hand and help each other up the ladder. So no wonder we have internalised the notion that women must somehow be inferior and worthy of less respect. Mahzarin Banerjee is professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Harvard and an expert on unconscious or implicit bias. This, as she told me, is how it comes about. Implicit bias comes from our social world, from our culture, because the content of what the brain knows is what it sees in the world. So I see that men do certain kinds of work and women do other kinds of work. If I had seen in my world that women were largely construction workers and engineers, that's what my brain would have learnt. And if I had seen in my world that men largely took care of children at home and cooked and cleaned for them, then that's what my brain would have learnt. We absorb the notion of male superiority from such an early age. British parents, when asked to estimate their children's IQ, will put their son on average at 115, which in itself is hilarious as the average ought to be 100, and their daughter at 107, a huge statistical difference. Why they do this is a mystery, as young girls develop faster than boys, have a bigger vocabulary, and do better at school. But the result is that boys on average grow up thinking that they're cleverer than girls, and vice versa. As early as 5, studies show that children believe girls aren't as good at maths as boys, even though they are. And when asked to choose teammates for a game for really, really smart children, young children of both genders are more likely to choose boys than girls. Yet at that age, girls are ahead of boys academically, and the children in the study knew it. American parents, meanwhile, are 2.5 times more likely to Google, "Is my son gifted?" than "Is my daughter gifted?" even though girls make up 11% more of the gifted and talented programs in US schools. No surprise, then, that adult men will, on average, put their own IQ at 110, while women estimate themselves to be just 105. Yet we know that, except for at the far extremes of the IQ curve, women's and men's IQs are distributed identically. Girls, on average, get higher grades at school and are more likely than boys to win places at university, master's courses, and beyond. The main reason for boys and men to think that they're cleverer than girls and women must be because their parents, teachers, and society have incorrectly imbued them with the belief that they are. Some readers will claim that this is all old hat. Aren't women now being favoured? In fact, aren't they now getting all the top jobs? Isn't it hardest of all these days to be a middle-aged white man, pale, male, and stale? Well, it is harder than it was, when all those characteristics conferred a massive advantage in every aspect of life. And it's true that some of the top jobs that have been held by men throughout their existence are at last having women appointed to them.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?